to your situation.
We'll start the meeting, and we don't have a forum yet, but I think it's time to get started. And you all have in your packet that handout of a non-PowerPoint, but I don't get dressed with a PowerPoint. But if you look at those slides, and George is seeing all these, but if you look at this one, this looks at various states and how they're ranked in quality and in cost for their Medicare services. This is from a paper in Health Affairs 2004, and you'll see that Minnesota is in the circle up there, is high on quality and low on cost. So that's what we have to work with in this state. And then in the same article from Health Affairs, there's a second graph that shows you the quality rank of the state versus the number of general practitioners or primary care physicians in the state. And you'll see that North Dakota and Minnesota have the highest percentage of general practitioners or family practice docs. And strangely enough, those are the two that are up there in the quality end. And the next one shows the spending on people in Medicare versus the number of general practitioners. And again, North Dakota and Minnesota are very low in spending and very high in the number of general practice docs. And we can skip this one because George is going to use that. And then I have one that is from a New England Journal of Medicine article in 2006 by Thomas Bodenheimer. And he talks about this one here. Talks about primary care and says that the average U.S. primary care doc has to have 2,300 patients. And then it looks at if they did just what evidence-based medicine said they should do, they would have to do 7.4 hours per day of preventive care and 10.6 hours per day for chronic care. So that comes to about 17 hours a day. And most people aren't willing to work that hard. And then I have this sheet that shows you what docs get paid. And you'll see family practice docs at $156,000, internists at $163,000, and orthopedic surgeons at $396,000. And I can tell you my wife's neurosurgeon makes $950,000. And he's a very good surgeon and a very nice guy. And this is the first time I've shown this. And this is so Dr. Sarah will get very mad at me. This shows the cost. It's the reverse of the number of general practitioners per population shows the number of specialists per population, and guess what? The more specialists you have, the lower quality of care and the higher cost. So, Dr. Sarah can talk about that when he gets here. The PJ, cardiac surgeon. And the last thing I want to talk about, somebody sent me a copy of an article by Robert Kuttner in New England Journal of Medicine in February. And he's a big single payer advocate. But he does have a case in there where he compares the primary care, and it's clear to me now that there's two main differences between our healthcare system and the other industrialized countries. The first one everybody knows about is that we don't have universal coverage, all the rest of them do. But they have all different kinds. They have single payer, Germany has 300 insurance companies. But the other thing that they have that's different than us is they all have a big higher emphasis on primary care.
And Mr. Kuttner talks about that, and I can tell you in Scotland, I've been to meetings where people of the Scottish Health Service were there, they got very concerned when their specialists were making 20% more than primary care docs. Okay. And they did things to increase the pay for primary care docs, so get them back up to even with specialists. And with that, I'll turn it over to George Schultz-Oyster.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Huxley, for inviting me here. I was asked to kind of give an overview of primary care, and so what I decided to try to talk about is what it is, why I think it's important in what you guys are addressing, and what I would suggest that maybe that means we ought to do about it, and I'll try to do that in a little over 10 minutes if I can. First of all, the definition that I started with here came from the Institute of Medicine put together a conference in 1994, and this is their final definition. Primary care is the provision of integrated, accessible healthcare services, accessible meaning barriers to that care have been eliminated, by clinicians who are accountable or responsible for what is going on, for addressing a large majority of the personal health care needs. And when I was taught in residency, we assumed that a primary care doc could address 90% of what walked in the door, developing a sustained partnership with patients, a long-term relationship, and practicing in the context of family and community. Another way to think about it is it's general practice. That's what it was called before family medicine became a board-certified specialty in the late 60s. And generalism is generally needed when there is a need for integration and coordination, which is going to be part of what goes on, and there is a need to see the big picture that includes all the nuances and connections and complexities of what's really going on with the issue. There are thought of as six fundamental principles to primary care. They call them the six C's. It's the first contact for care. There's continuity of care. Continuity of care can be thought of as continuity of place, continuity of information, which is part of the reason there's a focus on electronic medical records, and then continuity of person or personal physician. It's comprehensive. There's a coordination, and it's a coordination of essential care, as opposed to other kinds of care. One example might be the LASIK surgery I had a couple years ago. Caring in context of family and community, as we talked about a little bit ago, and then quality improvement. And I would think of the realms of primary care as not only just personal health, but includes mental health. It is often stated that somewhere between 30 and 50% of the office visits that I see every day incorporate or include some sort of mental health aspect. And then public health and community health are another way to think about it if it isn't a small town, it's population health. So, another way to think about primary care, I took from a book written by Dr. Eric Casal, who's a general internist. He wrote this about 10 years ago. He pointed out the distinction that primary care is patient-centered as opposed to organ or disease-centered, which is what a specialty would. So you'd have a specialty in your heart and a specialty in your pancreas and so on. And it addresses the fact that function and illness are what enter into a patient's story, so interventions are chosen and more effective if they consider the patient's life story. And so it's a real combination of what I would call the art and the science of medicine. And so primary care docs need to be able to know both the person and the information that's used in caring for that person, whether it's obtained through history or technology or their knowledge about the disease. And so generalism then becomes the skills that are needed to make that happen. And then the players, as you may recognize, are family docs, general internists, general pediatricians, nurse practitioners, and physician's assistants. And we could have a long argument that isn't important about whether it includes OB-GYN and other specialties. I would suggest that I think that will disappear in the future. I think the skills that needed to be a good obstetrician are not the skills needed to be a generalist. And I think that argument will go away, but for sure it includes these five players. So I'm trying to take you through a journey on primary care, and we've kind of reached a placid lake in a meadow in the mountains. And so, primary care is helpful in this situation because, and this is another example of what Representative Huntley was showing you. This is a different study. It was published in the American Family Physician in 2003. And just to understand the data, the bottom line, the primary care score ranking is a ranking based on how primary care based that country's system is. So if you could imagine, the one that's the most likely, number one would be England, and the United States, the least primary care based, is number 11 or 12, however you rank it here. Then the vertical axis is an outcomes rank based on the information on the right side of the chart. So it's based on patient satisfaction scores. It's based on some healthcare indicators that are going to be similar to HEDIS indicators and the number of medications used. So you get a higher, the better outcome is the lower score. It's the lower score. So it turns out the ones that have the best outcomes and the more primary care based are the lower left-hand side, and the ones that have the poorest outcomes and are on the not primary care based are on the right upper side. And it's kind of a linear ranking. On this particular study, it was a pretty direct relationship between whether the country was primary care based or not and how their scoring that came out of this particular study. But something that would be more relevant to us would be studies in our country, and again, goes along with what Representative Huntley showed you just a little bit ago. This was 2005 by Barbara Starfield, and basically the conclusion was the studies, when they looked county by county and counted the number of docs, what they found was, and this was universal, whether it was in Florida or New Hampshire or Wyoming or Texas, that if you could increase the number of primary care docs, you would decrease mortality by 5%. Now, you might say, well, that's because they live in different places, but in general, primary care docs are going to be more rural-based, which is going to have an older population, which you would think might have a higher mortality. But in fact, what they found was it decreased the mortality. There was also a decrease in cost. It wasn't 5%, but there was but again, goes along with what Representative Huntley showed you earlier. So what is a medical home? I'm not going to be exactly talking about that, but I could talk about that all day if you'd like. So I'm going to use it a little bit just to help understand primary care. It's not a structure, just like your home may or may not be your house. It's a couple things. It's an approach, which I'll try to talk about briefly, and it's support, a system of support for that approach. To give you some examples of what it would include, I'm just going to use some data here. This comes from the DHS Minnesota Medical Home Collaborative research project that they're doing. This particular data is from the pediatrics department in the system that I work in St. Cloud, CentraCare. You can see it's a couple years old. It was when they first started working in the project in this medical home project, and they were converting from their usual system of care into a more medical home-based system between 2004 and 2005. Basically, what it showed was that there was a decrease in the visits to the emergency room and unplanned hospital admissions as they introduced medical home, and that's going to be important. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later. The key, though, is where they were saving, already starting to show that money could be saved, was in hospital care. and they are still working on that project, and I don't know where their data is, so I can't show you the data, but what I understand that has come out of it so far is that what they have found is that what was more effective was if the clinic had a coordinator, they're more like they have care plans, a written description of what should happen when a particular patient with a chronic disease had an illness, and if they had a care plan, the outcome for that patient was better. And as I mentioned before, what has been shown in St. Cloud is there's decreased ER visits, decreased hospital days, and it turns out decreased cost of medication. You know, I don't remember who said this, but the reason you rob banks is because that's where the money is. So where's the money?
Oh, Willie Sutton.
Oh, thank you, Willie Sutton. So where the money is here in healthcare, that's what this slide is trying to show. The red line is the number of patients. So you can see it's at the beginning it's closer to 20%. At the top it's closer to, at the end it's closer to 80%. The main point of this, without spending a lot of time trying to follow, is that where we can look at to save money is through improving our care for chronic disease. So the patient-centered medical home model acknowledges that the best quality care is not the way we currently do it, which is episodic, illness-oriented, and complaint-based. So I still do this. Yesterday when I saw 20 patients, the first thing I said when I walked in the door was, and so what brings you here today? Most of the time, like I didn't know, most of them had diabetes or asthma or something. I knew exactly why they're here. About a third of them there were there because my office called them and told them it was time to come in. But the way I was taught and the way we function is, so what brings you here today? But what we know is what would work better is if it was patient-centered. You know, I give up physician-guided. That's not important today. Cost-efficient, longitudinal care that encompasses and values the support both of the art and the science of medicine, who the patient is and what is it that they have. But the key point that the reason I brought this up is I'm going to talk about patient-centeredness. So why is that important? What is it about that that is essential in this discussion? And I'm going to propose that there's two things that make that important. The first is the book that was published called Crossing the Quality Chasm by the Institute of Medicine, I think in 2003. It was the next book after they published their book To Err Is Human, where it talked about all the mistakes that happen in healthcare. And this was their suggestion about what we needed to do to get things better. And one piece of that was they listed six aims, six things that they thought should be accomplished to have a better healthcare system. And they were safety, effectiveness, timeliness, efficiency, equity, and patient-centeredness. And I went back to the book the other day just because I wanted to make sure I used their words, and these are the words right out of their book. Patient-centered means it responds to the needs, values, and the expressed preferences of the patient. And so that is what they meant by patient-centered. The other piece of evidence that I'm going to propose comes out of the Dartmouth Atlas Project. And that's, I believe, where some of those numbers that Representative Huntley was showing, I think some of that comes from that project, led by a doctor by the name of John Wenberg. But one of the conclusions they came out had to do with preference-sensitive care. And they were talking about both physician preference-sensitive care and patient preference-sensitive care. What they found was, what they were looking at is, why would the number of hysterectomies done in New Hampshire be different than the number they were in, I believe it was Miami or something like that. And what they found was it had nothing to do with what was wrong with the patient. It had nothing to do with what the patient wanted. It had only to do with what the physician chose. And so for the exact same reason, they would have a whole different magnitude of procedures performed in one place compared to another. And what they looked at when they finally studied the numbers, and it's way beyond me in terms of the numbers, but their conclusion was when patients make choices that truly fit their own personal values, the choices, it turns out, become more cost-effective for the system, they provide better satisfaction to the patient, they're happier with what gets accomplished, and the outcomes are better. And it was only if the patient was able to get what they wanted in that was consistent with their needs and values. And this, I forgot to mention, all this data is Medicare data, so this is all geriatric patients. So what they're actually proposing is that in medicine we do a better job of what they call shared decision making, which means you do three things. You make sure you discuss the science, what it can actually accomplish, that you get at values clarification with the patient so that they understand what's important to them, and then that you help make sure you include them in part of the decision making. In March of 2007, these four organizations came together with some core principles of patient-centered medical home. Includes a personal physician with ongoing relationships, the physician-directed practice where they're responsible for the care of the patient, for all of the needs of the patient, that's coordinated, integrated, get some examples of how that might occur. They talk quite a bit about quality and safety, which, again, I'm not wanting to get at today. And they talk about how do we eliminate barriers to access. And then they gave some examples about how that might occur. So we've been on our journey. We got through the meadow, and now we are about running into the mountain. The challenge of what we're going to do is, so how do we get there? And I think there's going to be two major issues that we're going to have to try to address. One of them I'm going to label as change, and the other is manpower. It could be woman power. That's just how much help we have. So change, what would need to happen for primary care to accomplish this is they need to do things differently than they're doing now, partially because we got trained differently, but partially because they have been rewarded for doing things differently, and they've at least managed to stay in practice, so they've paid the bills, and they paid the bills by getting paid, and they got paid because they did what was being rewarded, which is actually quite a bit different than what would need to occur. And this is an article that was in JAMA in 2006, and they talked about four specific things that would need to occur. We need to do a better job of eliminating barriers to care. We need to do a better job of continuity. We need to do a better job of that shared decision-making that I talked about earlier. We need to do a better job of getting patients involved with doing something other than the 15 minutes that we see them in the office every 3 months, and we need to do a better job of the overall coordination of care. So what that might look like, these are just some examples of things in the office that might help to define that. Again, not a real important part, but kind of talking about chronic disease registries and tracking and things that actually don't occur now because it isn't how we're structured. So the this comes from an article, another one in JAMA, and I thought this was prescient because this was actually even before I thought about medical home. And Dr. Grumbach suggested some things that would need to occur to make implementing medical homes happen. One of the things is he thought it would be important that it not increase the cost, the overall cost to the system, which is exactly, I'm sure, what you folks are thinking. His suggestion was the solution to that is to get the funding from institutional care. And the reason that's important is I am a family doc. I'm here because I believe in medical home, but I'm also happen to be president-elect of the Minnesota Medical Association, and our medical association is a strong proponent of doing what it takes to better develop the concept of a medical home and health care. And there's a lot of discussion about, well, why would specialists want to do that? Because as Representative Huntley pointed out, why would they want to let go of what they have? And I think what we're going to find is that the real solution is not going to be in taking the money from Representative Huntley's wife's surgeon, but it's actually going to come from the hospital. And the reason I think that is because what the data is showing so far that I see is it decreases ER visits and it decreases hospitalizations. That means the money comes from the hospital. Is that a problem? I actually had a conversation with the CEO of our hospital system two or three weeks ago as we were starting to look at the healthcare reform proposals that came out, and I asked him the question, so what happens if this really works? What happens if the ER visits and hospitalizations cut back in the St. Cloud Hospital? And he said, great. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he said, well, the number of visits is easy to deal with because that's all we have to do is cut back on staffing. And we can just do that. We can just cut back on staffing. We'll save the money, and then things will work just fine for us as the system, and the hospital will continue. And in fact, it'll deal with one of the big problems they are looking at is, what are they going to do for nurses anyway in 10 years when the nursing shortage hits? So they don't see that as a problem. Now, I can't speak for the hospital association. You'll have to have them come and talk. But that would be my belief. A second thing that needs to happen is that we need to get rid of what I call hamster medicine, and that's that 17 hours a day that you need to do everything that everyone says you need to do primary care well. And to do that, we need to figure out how to decrease the stress and the workload so we get the docs doing what we need them to do, which in fact means, as we've talked about in other settings, getting other people to work in the office at the top of their license. And then finally, that the systems and care have to improve access and the quality while they do that. And so lastly, the reason that this is important is if we don't figure this out, there won't be any primary care docs. And this is what I'm just trying to show here. This is the a listing from 1995 until 2007. Of the top line are the number of positions that were offered through the match, and everybody in that goes into residency training out of medical school goes through a match process. That's how you get where you go. And these are the number of positions that were offered in family medicine during those years. I actually ran a residency program for a while starting in 98, which it turned out was right at the peak of the number of spots. The red line is the number of positions that were filled by medical students that went to U.S. schools. And what you can see is that that has declined over the last 10 years, and the rate of decline is slowing, but it has not yet stopped. And so what you'll see there is, for instance, last year, this year it'll be next month when they go through the match. Last year, the number of U.S. medical students that went into family medicine was about somewhere between 35% and 40% of the spots. Now, what you need to know is then they go through a process to fill those spots after the match, and it ends up being around 95 or filled, but they get filled by osteopaths, which is okay, and foreign medical grads, which is also okay. My argument isn't that they shouldn't be there. My concern is, what is this saying about where we're headed? I think there's a lot of discussion going on about why they're not choosing primary care, but I think it has a lot to do with what we've talked about so far, and that is income and hence their medicine. But a new day is dawning. We're heading into a brighter day.
Questions for Dr. Schulpoister? So I had Dr. Doug Wood was here yesterday, and he talked about changing how primary care is being delivered. And currently, a primary care doc is supposed to have about 2,500 people in his panel, and that he thought that they could get that up to 4,000 if they used a real medical home and used nurse practitioners and nurses to the maximum level of their licensure. Do you have any thoughts on that? He said he didn't know of any studies that showed that. But.
I don't doubt that. The issue, the solution needs to be that we get away from the successful docs in my practice see 40 patients a day. What we need to do to get to a place where they see 10 patients a day and take care of the other 30 in some other fashion, which is through mid-levels, through phone calls, through emails, through home visits, through whatever else, whatever other creative ways that we can to provide care. And that would be, I think, what Dr. Wood was getting at, is how we would be able to handle 4,000, because you are using a larger team to take care of all the issues for the patient, rather than them only being taken care of when I see them for 15 minutes.
Representative Lossler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Doctor, I'm wondering if, you know, we've done loan forgiveness to try and encourage people to go into primary care, particularly in underutilized services. And I wondered if, having shared the experience with some medical students as they've agonized about what to apply for in residency and where to direct their career, if we might do better with offering actually reduced tuition at the front end rather than back-end loan forgiveness. You know, maybe it's a forgivable loan if they graduate with that primary care degree. I mean, I don't know exactly how to structure it, but I'm kind of thinking they just see the numbers on the loans, and they just, it seems to panic them at that point in their life. And the loan forgiveness seems so far away, but if you could comment on that.
It would make sense to me. It isn't something that I've worked on. I'm in our academy, our Family Medicine Academy. We had a committee that deals with resident and student issues, and they have looked at some of these issues. I don't know that they've ever talked specifically about what would the impact be of changing that to something different, so that it was clear that they weren't dealing with the numbers up front. That certainly might be. I think it's at least part of the barrier.
Representative Gottwald, this is going to have to be the last question because we have to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank the testifier. He happens to be my own primary care physician, so down here. I hope he didn't tell any secrets. We have to play racquetball one of these days. Just along the lines of what Representative Loeffler was speaking about, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Schefwester. Is it more important for us to change how we pay for things and give primary care physicians a career path that pays them more so that they're not incented to go into other specialty care professions? Or is it more important to give them the loan forgivenesses and those things up front, or does it need to be a combination of both?
My impression is loan forgiveness isn't working well, and I think that was why she suggested something else, and I don't know how that would work. It's my belief that the real solution will come in actually changing how they get reimbursed. And just to be real, very brief, the issue is we get paid to see somebody and do something to them. The more we do, the more that thing that we do that's called a procedure, the more we get paid. That's why the neurosurgeon, it says it's a $900,000 range, and family docs, which is all cognitive activity, is about $150,000. And so and there needs to be some sort of change, and again, we could talk long about how that would come about, but yeah, I think that's what needs to happen.
So thank you, Dr. Schefwester, and for your coming down here again. This is, I don't know how many times you've talked to us this year. Once with Doug Wood sitting next to you.
Yep. Thank you.
So thank you. Next we're going to have Mark Schoenbaum from the Minnesota Department of Health, who is in the Office of Rural Health and Primary Care.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me get my presentation up here. And I will try and keep us on schedule. Again, I'm Mark Schoenbaum, Director of the Health Department's Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. I've had an opportunity to present to many of you over the interim So you've heard some of the basics, and I will save some time by just touching on those lightly. So today, I hope to talk about some workforce issues, both urban and rural, to move on into health reform and talk about some implications there for our primary care safety net. I have taken the liberty of sticking to a slightly broader topic than strictly sticking to rural issues today. And the reason for that is when we look at access, we know there are any number of components that it takes to provide adequate access. Geography and distance are certainly one of them. And those are the often the foremost issues we think about when we think about rural health care. Affordability, workforce, cultural and linguistic acceptability are also key to successfully providing access to quality health care. And those issues play out differently in different parts of the state. So it takes the whole package of issues. And I'm going to try and speak to how that plays out in the safety net. You've got a safety net, both rural and urban. And here are some of the types of organizations and facilities that, when we think of the safety net, make up that definition for us. In rural areas, we have physician practices, rural health clinics, which are a specific type of facility, and rural hospitals. In the urban areas, we have community clinics and, of course, the big safety net hospitals. And there is a type of organization, a federally qualified health center, which many of you are familiar with, which has as its mission to serve the underserved, and we find those located statewide. Again, you've seen some of this before, but just to set the stage a little bit, here are some of the figures on the central primary care professions and how many providers we have in each of those occupations. 12,500 docs, almost 50,000 nurses, 2,600 nurse practitioners, and so on. And we know those providers are not distributed evenly. On this slide, you see the shortage areas, officially designated shortage areas in rural Minnesota and in Minneapolis and St. Paul. Perhaps of interest is that the basis for designating many of these shortage areas is both the raw number of primary care providers and the number of providers available to the low-income population. And that's what we see here in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So who staffs, who provides primary care to those safety net facilities? Here you can see primary care providers, both physicians and nurse practitioners and physician assistants, in what are classified as rural counties. You can see the same for our federally qualified health centers, and you can at the bottom see the same for what are the Census Bureau now calls micropolitan areas, which are our bigger rural counties. And here also we find recruiting and retention challenges. These are the vacancy rates for federally qualified health centers. The slide's a little bit blurry, but the blue is family practice, for instance, and it ranges from 17 to 12% in rural and urban health centers. So there are challenges recruiting and retaining primary care providers in the safety net. I know you're interested somewhat in nursing issues, and as with physicians, we have an aging nursing workforce. We've looked at this before. Kind of one interesting topic to note is that in Minnesota, we have seen new nursing programs open, and we are seeing an increase in nursing graduates. So that's a promising trend line. What is the state doing to support primary care? you can see here, and again, you know this, again, pretty well, your supporting programs at the Health Department, the Department of Education, MNSCU, your funding medical education and nursing education, loan forgiveness, and Representative Lawler is still there, or should we? I do want to respond to her question. I will anyway. And one of the ways that we are filling that gap, the slide that Dr. Schulpoister showed, and that you showed too, Mr. Chairman, about that gap between residencies offered and residencies filled, is we are filling that gap with foreign medical graduates who train in their home countries, get their medical license, and then come here for residency. And we've got a number of them in Minnesota.
It, nationally, it's about a third of the people licensed to practice medicine are foreign medical grads.
And perhaps Dr. Sarah can tell us, I mean, again, the share in residency programs is, I think, at least that much as well. So we've got this safety net, rural and urban. The state is supporting a wide variety, including some of these safety net programs. Here's what you could almost call kind of our field strength from our state-supported programs that is in place in the safety net. There's about 1,100 primary care providers in the rural and federally qualified safety net that I talked about earlier. Our loan forgiveness programs are filling about 10% of that, and similarly with foreign medical graduates. You know, it's an interesting conversation that takes place about loan forgiveness versus scholarships versus salaries and payment rates. I don't know that there's a right answer. We do know, I have to correct Dr. Schulpoister here, we periodically do evaluations of our loan forgiveness programs. And those evaluations, which I'd be happy to share, and I may have shared before, show that the programs do have a strong incentive effect on career choices of participants when they are selecting their work location and their job, and they do have a strong retention effect. Most of the people that begin to serve in an underserved area under a loan forgiveness incentive remain there once their 3 or 4 obligation has been completed. So they're pretty strong programs. In our field, as we talk about these things, there is no magic bullet. One of the advantages of loan forgiveness is that it is an incentive that is offered to someone when they're actually choosing a job. People, whether they are inclined to go into primary care, inclined to go rural, when they graduate medical school, they have many choices, and they will get many offers. Loan forgiveness is available to influence their decision, one factor to influence their decision, when they're actually making that job choice. The tuition and debt burden as people are making earlier decisions is certainly a big one. There are healthcare scholarship programs out there. They tend to be more expensive. And one of the things that the research literature shows is that the time that passes between when a beginning student, for instance, accepts a scholarship with a commitment to go into primary care or to go into rural or inner city, they make that decision when they accept that scholarship at the beginning of their education. And if they're a physician, for instance, 6, 7, 8, almost 10 years can pass. Things change while they're in school. Life circumstances change, family change, family circumstances change. We find a higher default rate in scholarships than we do in loan forgiveness. You know, both have a role to play. I don't know that, you know, one is necessarily the final answer or not. I think when I presented to you before, I said we need to do all these things. I guess that should remain a theme of mine. So we're doing these things. Are we doing enough? And again, you've also seen this slide before. This is a slide that leads me to the conclusion that under the status quo, primary care is falling off the cliff. The first line, the red line that's rising so quickly, is the aging population. The middle lines are the production of health careers graduates by the University of Minnesota. Those the first two lines on this slide I took from a slide Dr. Sarah used at one point. And I added the bottom lines, which are what we know about the retirement plans of providers now in the field. They're going to be leaving. They're kind of the inverse of the aging population is the aging healthcare workforce. So we're headed for a problem. What to do about it? You've got, I think, a very solid package of recommendations that has come out of your work at the Healthcare Access Commission and out of the Governor's Transformation Task Force. And I have tried to pull out those related to primary care and rural issues just to kind of put them in the spotlight with you today. A number of these have made it into the bills that are starting to emerge, and I think all of them are worth consideration. So expanding funding for primary care and rural physician training, similarly for advanced practice nursing, providing funding to address faculty shortages, I think all show up in some of the bills that are being introduced. Setting the contributions of pharmacies, mid-level dental providers, community paramedics, I think are all also worthwhile ideas. And I'm sure you'll have a chance to revisit them in the future. Some of them may not need direct state support and might have some momentum of their own. We do take exception to one of them, number six here. Loan forgiveness seems to be a topic today. Again, you've heard that we think it has an important role to play, as does increasing reimbursement for primary care. This recommendation, I think, kind of mixes and matches, attempts to mix and match and make a translation to things that really have different effects, and I'd be happy to talk more about it, but that's one that gives us some concern. So you've got, I think, if you were to do all these things, you would have made a contribution to the goals that you are after. Similarly, with the Transformation Task Force, one of its broader recommendations is to increase payment levels for primary care and for care management. Again, something we've heard about, you've been hearing a lot about, and Dr. Scheffweister mentioned already. There are some more specific recommendations of the Transformation Task Force, number two and number three, that talk specifically about incentives where there are shortages in different areas of the state, reducing barriers for entry, capping the potential of telehealth, modifying licensure requirements. I know modifying licensure requirements is something that some proposals moving through in the process already. They tend to be lively conversations. I think it's worth looking at. I think, however it turns out, I think as we've heard, finding ways to allow people to do what they're trained most deeply to do, and whatever level they may be at, they've got to be part of the solution.
Mark, if you could kind of move a little faster on the four slides, because we're running out of time here. We started late, it's not your fault.
I think I'm close to the finish line here. The Rural Health Advisory Committee, which advises the Commission and other state agencies on these issues, prepared a report last fall on rural aspects of healthcare reform. And I think the conversation that's going on here in the legislature is certainly consistent with what the Rural Health Advisory Committee thought should be the priorities for healthcare reform. We don't have all the answers, and I'll talk about that in a minute. In addition to looking at workforce, there are infrastructure supports that need to be in place to capture the potential of health reform and quality improvement and cost stabilization. We don't have all the answers on how this will play out in rural areas, but the Rural Health Advisory Committee has commissioned a new work group to look at just those questions, to look at the rural aspects of the medical home concept, and to look at other improvements and redesign opportunities, some of which I think there are some natural opportunities in rural communities. And that gets me to the end, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thank you, Mr. Schoenbaum, and we can we'll have to save our questions for you to till later, but you're usually around here. And the next person, Dr. Phil Bianco, has come a long way. Welcome to the committee, Dr. Bianco.
Well, thank you very much. This is a thrill for me to be down here speaking about something I feel very passionate about and been in practice for about 20 years now in rural primary care. I've always practiced in towns less than 4,000, and now in Ely, Minnesota. I've also had the opportunity to teach medical students through the course of my career, both anywhere from first-year medical students to residents, and have enjoyed it immensely, and I'm a great proponent of the importance of primary care. A lot of my first slides that you'll see here have to do with a lot that we've already talked about, but I want to put this slide out first. It's kind of the iconoclastic picture of the primary care physician walking across the field with a black bag. Now, I think this is a great picture. It's a model that is not sustainable. As you all know, you see the dark clouds approaching from the back. But what that represents, and it's something that I experience every day, is that what I do is relationship. And what we know about relationship with the patient is that it leads to better outcomes for that patient, which is the bottom line about why I went into this career. We have to maintain in any model that we establish this relationship, the relationship with the patient, the family doctor who is known by the patient and the family doctor who knows the patient quite well. But we have to do it in a different way for a number of different reasons. The reason, however, that primary care is so important is it gives you all of these elements, which you've already talked about. It's first contact, it's longitudinal, it's coordinated, it's comprehensive. It takes care of the whole person and his patient-centered. And that's essential. That's essential for the outcome of the patient. It's essential for their overall well-being. And this is what people want. This study shows that people prefer to have a primary care physician involved in their care. And if they should need specialty care in any fashion, they would like that primary care physician still involved. A healthcare system that is made up of fragmented care, and when I talk about fragmented care, that is what I refer to as specialty-only care. Go to the cardiologist, go to the gastroenterologist, go to the endocrinologist. It's fragmented, it's not coordinated, it leads to problems with the patient. And you've seen this in other slides in regard to mortality numbers that have already been presented today. And that if you have a primary care physician, not only is it cheaper care, which isn't the bottom line, but it's important as we're getting into struggles with our health care dollar, but it decreases mortality. Patients do better. And this slide shows this as well. And you've already seen these numbers out here, that is, the more family docs you have, the less mortality. The more specialty care, the increase in mortality. And again, you saw this slide earlier, so I'm going to move forward. And Dr. Hunt, Representative Huntley,
you can go through this because most of the members weren't here when I showed.
Okay. Well, this is looking at other countries that have, and basically what their primary care score is, and that is that the more load, essentially, within your system of primary care specialists, and this is what we're seeing in the other developed countries, And these countries, I mind you, when you look at the World Health Organization numbers, as far as quality of care, outrank us tremendously. We rank like 35th. But they outrank us. But the reason it is, and you can argue for days about single payer systems and all that type of thing. You know, that's one level. But the main level I want to say is that they have greater emphasis on having their population have contact with primary care physicians and primary care physicians coordinating their care. That's why they do better. And then,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, in what categories were in the last slide used for that outcome measure?
Well, they talked about who referred to it before.
If you look back on the handout that I have, it's a two lower right hand corner, and I listed what's there right beside the same chart I just listed what they mentioned.
He has it outlined on that chart. Has to do with drug utilization.
George, why don't you come on up and so we can hear it on the mic.
So what was measured was patient satisfaction, healthcare indicators, and they're the kinds of things like that HEDIS looks at. And the number of medications, so they did better if they actually used fewer medications. And there's a lot of, that's another whole discussion about polypharmacy
right.
We could talk about.
And then Representative Hunter, you passed this out before too, and again, it shows that Minnesota is doing, in relation to other states, doing better in regard to our quality rankings by Medicare data, in regard to the number of general practitioners or primary care physicians per 10,000 population. And the great thing about the scattered chart is if you just go right to the next one, it just kind of mimics itself in the sense that the cost is less. More quality care at less cost. So in bottom line, what we see with this type of system, which makes me really actually very proud to be a part of it, happy I went into the specialty, is because we all, every day, want to do something not only good for our patients, but we also want to do something good for society. And I believe that within this profession, within primary care, it is proven that we get better outcomes, less cost, and this is what people want. So, rural primary care challenges, how are we going to be able to sustain what we're doing right now? American College of Physicians used this great, I think, metaphor in that primary care is the backbone. In order to keep this system up, our healthcare system, we have to have strong, strong primary care. And these are some of the challenges. I'm going to talk about these a little bit more. We have a shortage of our primary care physicians. We're looking at aging populations. We have chronic disease management demands that are coming on to us. We currently have an inefficient model of delivery, and there are new demands by payers. And you've just seen this slide. We've talked about this. This slide you haven't seen. This is also general internal medicine. And what we're seeing in general internal medicine is with the light blue slide that shows the number of general internists coming out. And you can see that it's just like with family medicine. You're seeing the number of docs going into general internal medicine going down. You're also seeing the number of internists in subspecialties rising, going into specialized care. But then at the same time, you're also seeing in the dark blue more and more of these general internists going into the hospitalists. And when they're going to be hospitalized, they're not managing diabetes. They're not managing hypertension, okay? So that is another pool of physicians that we're losing to take care of our chronic disease management. And again, this is who they're going to be taken to care of, the baby boomers. You see the big spike with the baby boomers coming. So we have potentially less physicians and greater population with greater morbidity and disease to take care of. One thing unique that I want to make an emphasis on with rural medicine is that it's beyond just chronic disease management. I have to cover an emergency room, I have to deliver babies, and I have to do cesarean sections. These are all part of my day, beyond the demands of what chronic disease is there. And so when we're looking at family medicine docs, getting down now to only 23% of family medicine docs delivering babies. And even when we look at obstetrics, and obstetrics in the rural regional area, and I can tell you in northern Minnesota, we're running into a crisis in regard to the delivery of obstetrical care up on the Iron Range. These are huge factors. People have babies not when you want them to have them. They have them at all times of the day, and they're up in Ely on vacation, and they'll have their baby. So we have to be able to have skilled people in order to provide these services. And plus, if you're doing obstetrics, you've got to be able to do a cesarean section. That's just the bottom line. And if you're going to be doing a cesarean, you have to have enough docs to be able to do it, which is a physician, an assistant, and somebody to cover the baby. So it takes a load of people to do this type of work in the rural community. And same with the emergency room. A car accident out on 35W here that goes to Hennepin County is the same type of trauma that we get in our ER up in Ely. And so we have to do the same thing to those people in order to save their lives that happens down here. So these are the skill sets that also have to be present within the physicians in our rural communities. I also just want to comment on general surgery and colonoscopy screening. As we see colonoscopy screening becoming more of a gold standard as far as we screen for colorectal cancer, and we see the geographic problems for patients if they have to go to a major center to get their screening colonoscopies, it's a disincentive to them to have this procedure done. And the cost down the line for an undiagnosed colon cancer is tremendous compared to something that is found early or polyp removal that can eventually prevent colon cancer. So we have to be able to have these services available in the rural community for the overall health of the patient. So our payment systems right now, to me, seem kind of silly. I get paid for the click. Every time somebody walks into the door, and you've heard it before, the office visit is the way that we get paid. And, you know, it's been really nice within our system that we've been able to have measures now that give me my diabetes score number, how well I'm doing in regard to the parameters of diabetes management, parameters for hypertension management. I'm able to see that stuff. So now, you know, I would say, oh, I'm a pretty good doc. I think I'm doing well. But now I can see my scores. I can see how well I am, and I can see that in transparency to other physicians within our system. But what has gone on in the past is not how good my quality is, but how many people I see. That makes a difference to the bottom line of the clinic. And if I'm a lousy doc, it just makes sense that diabetics are going to do poorly. They're going to do much more poorly because they're going to have complications, whether it be kidney complications, visual complications, stroke, heart attack. They're going to do poorly. So what's going to happen? I'm going to see them more often. What happens if I see them more often? I'm going to make more money. That kind of system does not make sense. We're rewarded for the perpetuation of the illness. What we need to do is not push our docs, and the term being on the treadmill, the hamster, is not to push our docs any faster, but allow them the tools to move more wisely. So what happened was that somebody says, well, we're going to see how you do as far as pay for performances. And all of a sudden it kind of dropped into our lap. And what we found in the rural clinics and in our communities, I kind of felt this was the cart before the horse. It's somebody telling me to do a task without giving me the tools. And that is a part that's going on in a lot of our small rural communities. A lot of these communities do not have electronic medical record, which is essential to really getting an idea how you're doing as far as quality measures. We don't have the practice structure, the new care design to be able to work with teams, a new primary care model. And so what happened is it dropped down into our lap. And so what clinics are doing is trying to jerry-rig systems in order to get better performance. That's not consistent. And just in our clinic, I took one clinic and looked at the performance scores for diabetes. And this is basically consistent with all our rural clinics. If you had one doc who was really actually doing fairly well, meeting some pretty good standards, and not another doc that was doing poorly, does that tell me that one doc is a better physician than the other? I submit not. I submit that the one doc has a very motivated nurse or a clinical assistant who is really pushing the pages and calling patients up and getting people in. And to tell you the truth, that's what's going on. So what this tells me is we need a different model. We need a different model within our clinics in order to meet these? Because performance is great. It's fantastic. To be able to see your numbers and see that people are doing better, and in evidence-based medicine, that means less pain and suffering, that's great. But we need the tools to be able to do it. Representative Huntley showed this as well. It is going to be impossible to meet the demand on a patient. This is on a patient panel of about 2,500 patients. The amount of time necessary to take care of the chronic disease demands of that patient, 10.6 hours a day. This comes from a study by Yarnell. And he also looked at this in regard to preventive care services. So 17 hours a day is impossible in the model of the, as I showed you in the first slide, the doc with the black bag. It's not going to be able to be done. So the challenge is to do something different. And we talked about students, and I've had a lot of students. And we look at loan, you've already talked about loan forgiveness, but the reality of it is there's a great price range in what physicians are compensated. I just want to emphasize that students look at this. They look at this when they're talking about loans. It's a real thing. I've seen articles in which students have said, geez, you know, I can go into this profession or this specialty and not have it be so onerous and be able to not be in debt. That's just one of the factors. It's not all the factors, but I think it's an issue that needs to be addressed. And then when we're dealing with medical teaching challenges, again, I've always told my docs, take students, take as many students as you can, because just like it's relationship with the doctor, with the patient, it's relationship with the doctor, with the student. If students can find good mentors within primary care, there's a greater chance that they're going to go into primary care. But there's a real problem there because of the hamster. There are days that I'd have a student, I wouldn't want that student to be with me because I'm running my tail off and I'm not delivering as good of care as possible. It's important that we develop models of family medicine that allow us not to be on such a treadmill, so that then when we do have students, we can do quality teaching and the students can see that this is a sustainable specialty for the long term. Then we're not going to be dealing with burnout. Furthermore, residency survival. We have a number of family practice residencies in our state. But as we know with family practice residencies, they oftentimes see some of the poorest patients and have in the communities, and they also see a lot of patients without any insurance. So it's incredibly important that these residencies survive in order to put physicians out into the rural community. Finally, we talked about medical school debt or student debt already. But also be able to provide students with enough community experience. And I'm not just talking family medicine here. I'm also talking about a system within our medical school that provides students interested in OBGYN and general surgery to have exposure within our rural communities. Towns that are moderate size, Detroit Lakes, you know, Hibbing, someplace like that, in which they can see what this type of specialty care is like in a rural community, because this is a huge need as well, not just primary care specialty. So, this was the big question. Will primary care survive? And I basically say, for the sake of our nation's health system, it must. It is the backbone, and it provides quality care. It is the absolute backbone. Again, potential solutions, we've talked about these things, but this is something that I think that family medicine docs are excited about embracing. At SMDC, I've been on our group to remake our model, to create a new model of how we deliver care, utilizing everybody to the scope of their licenses, you know, utilizing our technology in order to take care of patients in a more comprehensive way. And when I go out and talk to our physicians about it, our family practice physicians about it, they're like so excited about something like this. They are very excited about this. And we have to create the payment systems in order to pay for models such as this, because there's so much work that's being done that is not being paid for by the click of the office visit. Okay. We have to promote the electronic medical record out into the communities, continue to review our curriculum in regard to our medical school. We have to support our residency program and we have to support rural obstetric practices as well. The pay equity resolution, as I talked about before. And then we have to really emphasize credentialed providers within the team, because credentialed providers can provide tremendous services out in the rural community, both in emergency room care and in the outpatient department, all kinds of things, different ways of looking at the way we utilize these people. So this is the healthcare curriculum. We have to stay, we have to be working at the top of this chart. You know, this is where we have to go. When we get down to chronic disease and morbidity, that's where specialty medicine comes in, and thank goodness for it. We have tremendous specialty doctors. But once patients get to that point, there is a certain degree of suffering that has already gone on, and a huge amount of dollars that have been spent. If we can stay up into this category and utilize the specialists in this category, the specialists who are primary care physicians, then we will have a very strong and viable health system. So, the dark clouds rolling in on the doc. We got to move from that doc there to a whole team of people delivering this care. So, I want to thank you again for allowing me to come down.
A couple of quick questions for Dr. Bianco. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is really more of a comment than a question. But first of all, thank you for coming down here to testify. I'm not quite sure, but I think that Representative Dean and I are the only members of the legislature who are married to physicians. We don't have any physicians actually in the legislature, but my husband happens to be a primary care doc. He's a general internist. And so I really appreciate your testimony here and you know, what you're talking about, because I think a lot of times the provider's perspective isn't heard that loudly here. And I just want to comment that I think that some of the solutions that we hear, sometimes I hear a kind of an underlying message that somehow it's the doc's fault. You know, that if people are not getting proper care for their chronic diseases, that it's somehow because the docs don't want to do that. And, you know, I think we have to be careful with our solutions, that we don't give that message, because I believe, in accordance, I think, with what you just were discussing, that docs, they're in the field because docs want to help people get well and stay well. And they want to give the best possible care. And what we need to do is make sure that they have the tools to be able to do that, rather than holding a stick over their head and saying, you better fix it at your peril.
Right.
And so I just wanted to make that comment, that I really appreciate your having come all the way here today to give your testimony.
It was hard when pay-for-performance first came out, because we were all kind of like shaking our heads and trying to figure out what to do, and it was really kind of a downer to see our numbers initially. But then once you start thinking about it, yes, it is the tools. It is. We just need a different system to be able to deliver this care. We have tremendous doctors. We have a tremendous medical school, it's allowed that to come forth with a different system.
Representative Gottwald, make it quick.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor. I also want to thank you for coming down. I just wanted to add the perspective of the Minnesota Rural Health Care Advisory Committee, which I served on over the summer and will be on a go-forward basis. But a lot of discussion about the need, once again, to change how we pay for things. That's the real answer. If we provide a career path that pays people well for doing all this work that you're talking about, especially in rural areas, then we have a chance of attracting more people to rural areas on a sustainable, permanent basis. So obviously that has to be part of the equation, paying more for primary and preventive care. And the other point I want to make is the healthcare reform efforts that we enact, again, need to include some of what Representative Liebling was referring to, and that's an incentive for people to begin to take better care of themselves. We can't make it all the primary care doc's responsibility. If somebody isn't taking care of themselves, nothing the doctor is going to do is necessarily going to change that. Couple of important points.
Yes. As we did our healthcare model, one of the big people on that was the patient, being able to educate the patient and get them
involved in their health care. And as you know, if they are more involved in their decision making, that type of thing, they'll do better.
Thank you, Dr. Bianco, for coming and testifying. And if you stay around, I'll talk to you when we get done here. Next, we have Dr. Frank Serra, Senior Vice President of Health Sciences at the University of Minnesota. And until August 30th was my boss.
And I fired you. Sorry, Representative Hunt.
This is Martin Luther King said, free at last, thank God I'm free at last.
I better redeem myself here with a couple of sentences. Representative Huntley was an outstanding faculty on the faculty. A biochemist who understood healthcare was a real treat. Mm-hmm. So when he retired, I was actually sorry to hear him go, see him go from one aspect, but the fact that he's really become an expert in healthcare, I view as a real positive for all of us. I'm not going to repeat what you've heard, but I do want to deliver a couple of different messages, one of which is you've been hearing mainly about docs. I'm going to talk a lot about nurses and pharmacists, and maybe a little about dentists, because I think they're a big part of the solution, and I'm going to break through this highest and best use of license and simply tell you, until we start using nurses to do a lot of chronic care and pharmacists to do medication management, we're not going to solve this problem. And part of the reason I'm going to put on your plate is you can't afford and we can't afford to train enough primary care docs to solve the problem. That's really my message.
Thank you, Dr. Farrell.
The whole thing. You've seen this, but I want to make a point about the next one. This is a whole Minnesota problem. This is the 94 corridor through the Twin Cities. And it is just as underserved for primary care docs, dentists, and mental health as the rest of the state. So I want to let you think about that for a minute. Because our problem is right here in the Twin Cities as well as in the rest of the state. And that's worth pondering, and many of the issues are the same. A lot of things are working. The Rural Physician Associate Program, we've instituted a lot of community care dentistry through our partnerships with MinSCU. In the last 3 years, we've seen 100,000 more dental patients who never got seen. We've increased our class size in pharmacy. We have about 25 new pharmacy graduates who are practicing in greater Minnesota. We've partnered with the Mayo Clinic on recruiting underrepresented students right out of high school and channeling them right into the Mayo Clinic. I'll also point out to you that I'm working with the School of Dentistry and its dean to actually prepare this mid-level dental practitioner, because I believe you need the faculty of the School of Dentistry to define what that scope of practice is and what the education is required for those middle-level practitioners in order to have competent practitioners with competencies that you'll actually not worry about at night as to what's being practiced. So what are we actually doing? Our medical school class size is up 10%. 80% of them are from Minnesota. We plan to go up another 10%. And I'll come back to that, because just because you put more students in the system doesn't mean they're going to end up in primary care and doesn't mean they're going to end up in rural Minnesota. The students have the right of choice, and you've heard that from a lot of different people. College of Pharmacy, we now have 150 students enrolled in our Duluth campus as well as another 150 on the Twin Cities campus. A large percentage of these students, when they finish, are practicing in greater Minnesota. These are the PharmDs. This is where the data says very clearly, if you involve these people in medication management as independent practitioners, the patients are more satisfied, the cost plummets, and the error rates go to zero. Marked increase in quality, marked reductions in cost. It is not being utilized well in the state. nurse practitioners, our DNP program, Doctor of Nursing Practice, just graduated its first class this year. These are people who are well qualified to do a lot of prevention, a lot of chronic disease management, and a lot of chronic care delivery. School of Dentistry, our class size is up 25%. We've rotated 300 students through Hibbing, Wilbur, and South Dakota, and we're opening up clinics whose sole purpose is Medicaid and indigent patients. This is a part of the solution. I believe the demand is such for the dentally disadvantaged access that we do need a mid-level practitioner, and as I said, I'm working on that with Dean Lloyd. We're the only producer of public health students, and our class size is way up now, and we think we're meeting that demand. Vets, constant demand for vets, particularly large animal vets. There's a very strong connection, as you see in the paper, between food quality, food safety, and your health. Without the vets, we're in big trouble. So we're increasing our class size there. We're working with other schools in a vet class program, which really puts people into large animal veterinary practice in a big way. The unspoken out shortages, the technician level, clinical laboratory science, occupational therapists. You funded a program. It's now open in Rochester, so we have two campuses open in occupational therapy here, University of Minnesota, Rochester. Our class size in the Twin Cities campus in clinical laboratory science is up to about 44 students. Our campus will open at University of Minnesota, Rochester as a joint program with Winona State University in the fall of this year. We'll be up to 88. We plan to now look at central Minnesota, northeast, and northwest Minnesota for three other programs, and this is all coordinated on the most modern of electronic learning platforms that you can get. The students can go to school in their home, they can train in their local hospitals and clinics, and for the most part, they can complete their degree requirements that way. So that's a big step forward. When we look at Greater Minnesota, we actually use the model that was developed in the medical school at Duluth all over the place now, which is you recruit them in Greater Minnesota, you train them in Greater Minnesota, and the likelihood is they'll stay in Greater Minnesota to initiate their practice. I didn't say you could retain them there. That's a different issue. So we know that this model works, and you've heard this from several different points of view, and as part of that model, we now have students in 2,000 clinics, hospitals, and communities in the state of Minnesota. So we're providing more and more opportunity for what you heard from Dr. Bianco, those local relationships. That's critical in recruiting and then retaining students in the various professions. You've heard a lot about this, and I'm not going to spend a lot more on this. I want to give you some information that we've gotten from student interviews about why they didn't go into family practice or primary care. I'll use the more general term. Well, if a student came from a small town or a micropolitan community, as they say now, and they go to school in our school and they enter our residency programs, the likelihood is they'll stay. The problem you have is if you look at the medical school class, no matter where they enter, whether it's Duluth or Twin Cities, only about a third of them end up in primary care. And that means they go through medical school, they go through a residency, and then they go out to practice. So overall, if you multiply all those percentages and you convert it to numbers, only about a third of each entering class. That's kind of where we are. If they get into our primary care residency programs, about 75% of them will stay in the state. Problem is getting them in. It's the choice they need to develop. You've heard about the cost of medical education and the amount of debt. The average debt for a medical student this year is going to be about $170,000. It's going up, not down. I'll come back to that in a minute. Economic considerations, you heard about reimbursement. It's a big, big issue, and the adverse incentives are enormous. There are other problems that are just in the communities that we can help with, but we can't solve. We need to partner with these communities. Lifestyle aspirations. Most students, if you talk to them now, the new generation, they're not interested in working 70, 80, and 90-hour weeks. They're not interested in being called every night and every weekend. On the average, you have to hire 2 to 3 docs now to get one full FTE because of the coverage issues. There are these changing views of what life is about for them, and that's their choice. You could say we made them that way. I don't know. That's another discussion. But they want personal development. They want it's hours worked and those kinds of things. Spouses. Many, many students are married. And if they're not, where they go live, the spouse has a lot to say or the partner has a lot to say. It's a big issue. Geographical aspirations. Some people like to live by the water. Some people like to live by the Guthrie. And I don't know how changeable that is. I do know we looked at the nursing shortage in northwest Minnesota along with Minsk, our Minsku colleagues. Our problem there was not production. We were producing 2 baccalaureate nurses for every slot that was open, but there was a shortage because they couldn't retain them in the area because of lifestyle and pay. So this is a complicated kind of issue. This is what we've learned. What it says to me is you can't solve this without community partnership. We have to work together, and I've begun to travel the state and have these discussions to see what we can do to help. I'm not going to spend a lot more time on this, and I want to come back to this, which my friend Dr. Schoenbaum showed you a piece of. His slide actually is better than mine, but this is the one I have in here. That purple line going up is the population increase. The rest of these colored lines is our production rate. There are 2 messages here. We can't produce enough in the current model to solve the access issue. Number 2, if you told me to do it, I would ask you for nearly $1 billion over the next 10 years. I think we're going to be $1 billion the other way tomorrow, but I worry about that. We cannot afford to educate more people in the same way, to practice in the same paradigm. It's a miserable failure if we do. So, what are we doing? Well, you're not going to hear a lot of disagreements today. I think your 4 presenters are pretty much in agreement. We may disagree about some of the definitions. We're going to strengthen the pipeline for primary care. We've increased our class size, we'll increase it again, and we're then going to try and put in incentives for primary care careers. I believe you do need scholarships on the front end to reduce tuition. There are several donors who are interested in that. The other schools are interested in partnering with us from the undergraduate to the graduate program, but ultimately scholarships are the answer to that. Just driving tuition down simply puts the medical school in big trouble. So we got to come up with scholarships on the back end. I think you have to do loan forgiveness. The problem I see with the loan forgiveness program today is it's small. You have very few docs on it, but their quota is full. So we could do a lot more with loan forgiveness, and I think it would make a difference. But I think you have to tie it to years worked in rural communities. Number 3, I think there are other things we can do in working with communities to improve the attraction and retention rate. There's a lot of foreign-trained talent in the state. Maybe there's a way of tapping that talent, and maybe there's a way of retraining previously licensed physicians. Believe it or not, there are some people that don't like to practice general surgery anymore and like to do other things. So I think that's an option. Where I think some of the biggest gains can come are to develop new interprofessional models of care delivery in partnership with the healthcare system. I will be calling a general meeting this fall of the CEOs of the healthcare systems in the state of Minnesota to look at this problem. I've talked with all of them, the last one of which was Peter Persons last week. We had a 2-hour conversation, and they're willing to come to the table and look at new care delivery models that allow physicians, PharmDs, and nurse practitioners to function as independent practitioners in coordinated care delivery models. That's a very different thing than you're hearing today. So I think it's not the topic of conversation today, but this new DNP nurse is designed for that, and I don't ever think you'll replace what physicians really do well, the differential diagnosis and complicated medical decision-making and relationships with patients that are respectful and very, very strong. But there are other kinds of providers that can do prevention, chronic disease management, and medication management. We're actually piloting in the University Health Plan in Duluth. If you're on more than four medications, you got to see a clinical pharmacist and have your medications managed. Free, actually, if you do that, too. Then I think we have to leverage technology, and you've heard a lot about that, to really get the evidence, to really get access to care and care delivery. I think you have to do that. Do I believe in an educated consumer? I think in certain circumstances, yes. There are certain groups of people you can train how to manage their disease. Diabetes is a great example. Mine didn't come under control until I finally said, Frank, you got to manage it, and then work with your diabetologist when you need that. Work a lot with your primary care nurse, and work a lot with your primary care doc. You know something? My A1C, 5.8.
Wow.
Doable. But you have to take the time to educate. And I think you're going to find in many areas of inner city and elsewhere, that's not going to be doable in a simple way. So, I promote educated consumers. I think there's a role. Major changes, I think, in how we actually pay for health care. And this is the pathway that we're on. And I'd be happy to field any questions. Thank you for the opportunity, Representative Fonley.
It's going to be very brief because we have another committee that's going to be in here in about 3 minutes. So, Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and for Dr. Sarah. One of the things I've been thinking about a little bit, and I'm wondering if you have advice for us, is when we're thinking about the education of the various providers that make up our primary care team, what attention is being paid to education and training as a team at the very root of their education? Because I think this model purports that they need to work together as a team, and currently I don't think we address that very well.
I would give a quick response, Mr. Chair. Representative, we have now a Center for Interprofessional Education. We start in year one of all entering classes. The deans have all agreed on 10 mandatory courses, and we're going to do more, including the experiential end. The first course is, what does it really mean to have team care? We all think we understand that. I can tell you, we don't. But there is a science of teams, and that science of teams needs to be taught. What it needs to be a leader, what it needs to be a follower, what it needs to be to work with professionals across boundaries and so on. So that is a major piece of our curriculum today. And you funded it.
Representative Anderson, you get the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sarah, you mentioned here preventative management for chronic diseases, and I'm wondering if you think the medical home that they're proposing would be a part of the solution to the prevention or the management of chronic diseases.
I'm glad you asked this question, Mr. Chair. I'm a strong proponent of the medical home. It's the right concept. My quibbles were around what our first presenter talked about, physician-centric homes versus homes of independent practitioners. I just think those are models that need to be tested, and we'll find out what the best quality for the best price is. But I believe the medical home concept, as a concept, is the correct concept.
Well, thank you, Dr. Sarah, for coming and making your very exciting presentation. And the meeting is now adjourned.